There was a huge accumulation of snow, not only on the sides of the runways, but also at the ends. And because it was hard to see, the engineers or somebody had stuck some black poles, whether metal or wooden, I don't know, into these banks of snow at the ends of the runways. And I had evidently hit one of those poles coming into land, but I never knew it until the crew chief told me about it. I didn't hear anything or feel anything. Some people thought it was very amusing that the flying safety officer of the base should have had an accident himself, since it was so classified. That didn't bother me very much. There were two civilians on the base, and I forget what outfit they belonged with. That is to say, I forget what the outfit was called. It was sort of like a counterintelligence group, and it was their business to be on the alert for sabotage and so forth. And because of that, they were always keenly interested in any aircraft accidents which took place. One of the men was married, and the other one was not. The married one, I forget his name. But I was on very good terms with both of them, and the unmarried one was a young fella named Bud Deary. I think it was D-E-A-R-Y or D-E-R-E-Y, I don't know. But it was Bud Deary anyway. And he was a small fella about my size and not much older than I. And since we worked together a lot, we got to be very good friends. And used to spend a lot of time together that wasn't in the line of duty. I mean, wasn't necessitated by our activities. We would just like to talk to each other. And I remember on one occasion when we lost an airplane with a trainee in it. This airplane apparently the ceiling was rather low, not terribly low, but rather low, and he had this trainee had apparently become disoriented somehow, and had got himself into a dive and didn't know how to recover. This is not as silly as you may think. And flew into the ground at a very steep angle. And this was some miles away from the base. And I went over to the accident site. Bud Deary was already there, and there were other people there from the base. It was remarkable in that the airplane must have struck the ground with a tremendous impact, because there was nothing left of it. There was a very big hole full of oil and gasoline and water. And on either side of the hole, there were two sort of troughs, where the wings had hit. But there was no sign of any airplane at all, and very few pieces of metal even. Just nothing. This hole, really. And I remember walking around the site a little bit and saying to Bud Deary, I said, you know, this airplane struck the ground upside down. We knew from some spectators from what direction the airplane had come through the clouds and down, but nothing was said about its having been upside down. I don't know that anybody knew that. And Bud said, well, how do you know that? as I said, beside, on either side of the hole, there were two sort of troughs where the wings had hit. And at the end of the left trough was a piece of green glass, which I recognized as coming off the wing light, and at the end of the wingtip, and on the at the end of the right-hand trough, there was a piece of red glass, which I recognized as being off the wing light on the left wing. So if the left wing hit on the right-hand side and vice versa, the airplane had to have been inverted at the time it hit. And remember Bud Deary saying, well, he said, you must be right. That sort of thing is what makes a good investigator. A little later on, we found the pilot, a youngster. He had apparently bailed out just seconds before impact, far too low to do him any good. And although he must have sustained what the doctors call massive internal injuries, none of that was apparent. He was simply lying on the ground exactly as though he were fast asleep. And there was not the slightest sign of injury about him. Mostly, we didn't lose very many people, lives. We lost a fair number of airplanes and damaged a fair number. But lives, we didn't lose very many of. I remember one stupid accident took place with a kind of smart-ass trainee who was up flying formation or something in a P-47, of course, and he suddenly became aware that sticking out of the cowl flaps was a Coke bottle. Well, the truth is that a Coke bottle was not supposed to be there, and it really was no great cause for alarm. It was a cause for amazement, I suppose. But this youngster got terribly upset by this, and his flight leader told him to return to base, which he did. But he was so excited over this incident that he forgot to change gas tanks, and on final approach he ran out of gas on one tank. He had plenty of gas in the other tanks. And I want to tell you, that airplane sheared off a beech tree that must have been at least 8 inches in diameter. Just chopped it right in two. And the whole thing came down to the ground, tree and airplane and all, without, it didn't hurt the pilot a bit. He obviously was shaken up. It didn't damage him in any way. And I always considered the accident rather stupid in that just because he saw a Coke bottle, which had no business being there, was no reason to get so flustered that he forgot to do what he was supposed to do. After all, the airplane wasn't acting up or doing anything that it shouldn't have done. The engine ran perfectly well. Needless to say, however, there was a great uproar made over that down at 5th Fighter Command when the report went in. The procedure was to send in a teletype report immediately when an accident happened, and then you supplemented it later with a long, detailed form. It was a legal-size form in four parts, and it was my business to fill it out. But I remember when we sent in the teletype, we immediately got another one back from Mitchell Field saying, "What do you mean? No, I think they said, "Please explain the presence of a Coke bottle in the engine cowling." Well, obviously, some mechanic had been working on the engine, drinking a Coke, and set the bottle down and forgot about it and put the cowling back on. There it was. Anyway, a big fuss was made over it. Perhaps with some reason, it was inexcusable, certainly. Sometimes there were semi-humorous aspects to these accidents. One of them concerned a very cute little Irish boy. I call him an Irish boy. His name was Sullivan. I don't suppose he was any more Irish than I am, but something happened in the air. I don't know what it was. Something happened that shouldn't have happened mechanically, and he elected quite properly to return to base. And he did so, and he landed. And again, I forget the reason for it. It was an erroneous reason, but it made sense to him, and nobody blamed him for it. Anyway, the long short of the story was that he put the brakes on too hard and too fast, and the airplane nosed over and turned upside down. And when the firemen got out there, they were trying to elicit some response from this kid to find out if he was hurt or not hurt or whatever, and they couldn't get a sound out of him. Nothing, just dead silence, which made them uneasy because it wasn't likely they could get him out of there very fast. Since it was upside down, it would take a crane to lift it up. But anyway, one of the firemen, according to the story as it was told to me, I wasn't there at the moment, one of the firemen said he thought he noticed some smoke coming out of the wreckage. And maybe he did. It wasn't significant. But anyway, he said to someone, "I think this airplane is on fire." And no sooner had he uttered those words than there came the damnedest pounding and screaming and hollering and banging from the cockpit. Kid Sullivan saying, "Get me the hell out of here." I can't say I blame him. I think probably he was so shocked by what had happened that he was hanging in there upside down trying to sort of put his mind back together. But the minute that he got the notion that he might burn to death, he became unshocked in a hurry. We also had one time an accident of a different nature. It was the end of the day in a summer afternoon, I believe, or whatever it was, doesn't matter. Couldn't have been summer, come to think of it, but end of the day, late afternoon, and flying was off, and I was getting ready to go home or go to supper or something. When I looked up and I noticed some miles away, and several thousand feet in the air, a B-24 flying along. North. Incidentally, we weren't all that far from Westover Field, Massachusetts, which was a big B-24 bomber base at that time. And this plane was obviously headed back for Westover Field, but anyway, it was also obvious, the more I looked at it, that the airplane was on fire. And I raced over to the fireplace and, fire station, and notified the firemen because the airplane was still flying, but they became alerted to this, and it was a few seconds later the airplane started going down, you know, long glide or something. It didn't just nose over and go straight down or anything, but it was obviously not going to reach base, and it was going to crash somewhere in the hills. I jumped in my car, and of course the fire trucks took off in the general direction of where it looked like this airplane might go down, and I went off in my car in the same direction, and we got to the scene of the crash after dark by that time. And it had struck a hillside and so on, but it was a low hill, and it knocked down a bunch of trees and skidded along and disintegrated pretty much. And there was gasoline all over the place and wreckage. And I got to a phone at some nearby farmhouse and called the Bradley Field Hospital and asked them to send a bunch of ambulances over, And they wanted to know how many people were hurt and killed and all. Well, at that stage, nobody knew, and I certainly didn't know. I just told them that we needed enough ambulances for the whole crew, it would seem to me. And when I finished doing that, I ran into the co-pilot, who was wandering around dazed and pretty much out of his head. And he kept saying to me, "I have to find my buddy. Where's my buddy? I got to find my buddy." Well, things were pretty chaotic, and there were some idiots around there that who were smoking, despite the fact the whole place was saturated with gasoline, and we had to put a stop to that and get people out of there. The pilot, however, was jammed in the cockpit and couldn't get out and couldn't be gotten out. The firemen started to work on that, trying to get the thing. They had equipment for that sort of rescue stuff, but even so, it wasn't easy, and the pilot was pretty badly injured. And somewhere along the line, I remember... We got everybody out of there, alive or dead, except the pilot, who was still wedged in his seat. And he was making a fair amount of fuss, as I remember. Anyway, one of the doctors got there and apparently gave him a shot of something. Because within minutes after that, this poor bastard started laughing and joking and carrying on and making a big fuss, all like I say, all laughter and somewhat hysterical, I suppose. But it was a bizarre scene. Anyway, the damnedest thing happened after this accident, in that it was a Westover Air Force Base bomber, and it was up to them to investigate the accident. It wasn't me, wasn't my in my jurisdiction, but since I had been instrumental in it and was a witness and all, they called me up there one day to testify at a hearing. Well, in the first place, the simple thing to do would be to just take a P-47 and fly up there. It was only 30 miles away or something. And they refused permission for me to fly up there. And I'm talking about the people at Westover. And when I got there, they treated me exactly as though I had caused the accident. They were very unfriendly and cut me off in mid-testimony several times and would say things like, "Captain, that's not what I asked you. I asked you thus and so." And they were very unfriendly. And what the idea behind all this was, I have no idea, but it was an unpleasant experience. And then they just sent me home without a thank you or anything else. Nasty people. We had another accident up there once, near there somewhere, which didn't involve one of our airplanes. It involved an airplane that I'm not familiar with much. It was a low-wing monoplane, a Curtiss airplane of some kind, and not any well-known type. I don't remember. It was a big thing and a two-place thing. Anyway, it had been flown up to Bradley Field from Mitchell Field by two colonels, two full colonels. One of them was a man, I wish I could remember his name, Dick, but he was from Richmond, Virginia, and a well-known name there. If I had heard it, I'd know it. Because even then, I knew the name was well enough known that I knew what family he was from and all in Richmond. But I can't think of it now. Anyway, I forget the details of the accident or any of that, but since it happened in my jurisdiction, it was incumbent upon me to do the investigating. And the more we investigated, the more it became apparent that the accident was a pilot error out and out. He ran out of gas on one tank or some such thing. Well, the colonel, the pilot, was in the hospital down at Mitchell Field, and I flew down there one day to take testimony from him. And whether I was aware of it at the time or not, I don't know, but this colonel really gave me what I suppose today we would call a snow job or something. Anyway, butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, and he lay there in that bed, and he'd say, "Now, Captain, you've flown a lot now, and you know how these things are, don't you? Don't you?" "Yes, of course, you would know. You're a pilot." "Yeah, well, you see," and he went on and on. He knew damn well it was a simple pilot error, and inexcusable at that. But he was an older man and didn't fly very much, so it probably explained it right there. But anyway, before I was done with this interview, he had me eating out of his hand and hoping, no doubt, that I would put the most favorable possible light on my report. And perhaps I did that, I don't know. But, Dick, I remember that man's name, Massey. Colonel Massey, his name was. I think the Masseys are well-known people in Richmond, or were at that time. Colonel Massey. Incidentally, this is neither here nor there, but Richmond, the Richmond Airport, was also one of the first fighter command bases. We had the P-47 training unit stationed on that base. Even though it was also served at the same time as the Richmond Municipal Airport. It was called Byrd Field even in those days, I think. The base commander at Bradley Field was an old, wizened, dried-up fellow, a full colonel who had been in the Air Corps Reserve and was called to active duty when the war started. He didn't fly. He practically didn't. He did fly a little. Enough to get his flying time in or something, but you couldn't get him to fly a P-47 to save your life. Though before I left there, they did. Finally checked him out and he flew one, but mostly he wouldn't and didn't. But he was a crotchety, mean old bastard, and nobody liked him very well. But thank God, for some reason, he took a great shine to me. And he was always calling me into his office, and sometimes it was apparent he just wanted to talk. And he was always very nice to me. And this was a great advantage, because most people were afraid of him. I suppose I was too, except that it put me in the position from time to time when necessary of being able to say, "Well, I'll talk to Colonel Johnson about it," or "I don't think Colonel Johnson's going to like this or that," and that was enough to for me to end up getting my way. We had some strange things there. By strange, I simply mean conditions existed which shouldn't have, it seems to me, at any place, and rather obvious ones, but nobody had ever thought of it, and nobody had ever done anything about it. And one of them was that I discovered that the firemen, incidentally, I think probably I discovered this as a result of that accident that Kid Sullivan had. Anyway, the firemen on the base, who of course appeared regularly at all accidents, naturally they were the first ones there, they didn't know how to open the canopy on a P-47 or how to remove it. Or they didn't know any of the basic things about that airplane that really, as firemen, they should have known, which in certain circumstances would have been knowledge they just should have had. So when I found this out, I went to the fire chief and told him that that's the way it looked to me and that we should do something about it. And lo and behold, he and all his firemen were welcomed me with open arms, and they said, "We have always wanted to have somebody tell us this stuff, and nobody ever would. We've asked and asked. Nobody was ever paid any attention to us. Nobody's ever offered to tell us anything or show us anything, and we'd be delighted." So I set up some classes, and I would take groups of firemen, two or three at a time, out to the airplane and show it to them in some detail, and explain the fuel system, which was certainly something they should have known about. They should know where the gas tanks were and how to remove the canopy and how to do this and that. And this worked out very well, and it was information that I was able later on down at Mitchell Field to make good use of at other bases, because it turned out it wasn't only Bradley Field where the firemen didn't know anything about P-47s. They didn't know at the other First Fighter Command bases either. In most cases, I'm sure there must have been exceptions to that. There was one slight amusing thing that I forgot to tell in its proper place, and I have hesitated whether to tell it now or not, but I think I shall, because it always amused me. It concerns the time that my brother Dick was visiting me, and Dick took a great shine to the food in the officer's mess, and on one occasion he said to me, he said, "I wouldn't mind eating the garbage from this place." A couple of days after President Roosevelt died, the base was closed, and there were ceremonies held for his funeral. And the officers had to march around a little bit, and of course none of us had marched for a couple of years, needless to say, we weren't very good at it. That wouldn't have mattered so much, except for the fact that my brother Jack was visiting at the time, and of course he, being a good VPI man, was, shall I say, humorously critical of our marching, which indeed he might well have been. However, that visit from Jack was notable because, as I said, flying was called off on this occasion, and the base was sort of closed as far as flying was concerned. Everything was deserted as far as activity on the field was concerned, the flight line and all. We had at Bradley Field an AT-6, which we used for instrument checkouts. We had to have a two-place plane for that, and we used this AT-6, and it was like new. It was a damn nice airplane, and it was kept in a hangar way across the field from the main flight line. And I decided that I was going to take Jack for a ride in that AT-6. Now, needless to say, this was absolutely, positively, grossly against any regulations to take civilians up, except under certain circumstances, and there were none of those circumstances prevailing at that time. On the other hand, there was nobody much around, and the AT-6 was way across the field where there was hardly anybody over there except the crew chief, and I figured I'd not get caught at it. I might as well mention right here and now that I didn't get caught at it either. So we got some parachutes and drove across the field and up there, and I had talked to the operations officer and said I want to use the AT-6 for a while just locally, and he said, "Okay, go ahead." So when we got over there, the crew chief was expecting us, and so I got Jack in the back seat and with his parachute and explained how to use it and how to open the canopy and all that jazz, and then I got in. We were ready to go. Only problem was that I couldn't get the engine started, and this seemed to puzzle the crew chief a good deal, and he climbed up on the wing and looked over my shoulder, and mentioned the fact that perhaps it would start if I turned the ignition switch on. I must have been a little bit rattled. Anyway, it did start, and I took Jack for a ride, and I think we both enjoyed that. I remembered at one point he said, "Can you do a loop?" Well, I didn't really like doing loops very well, and I hadn't done them in that airplane for a long time, a couple years, I suppose, and I said I was afraid you'd ask that, but anyway, it wasn't that much of a big deal. We did a loop, maybe we did several, I don't know, but came back anyway, and Jack enjoyed it, and nobody caught us. I'm sure the crew chief must have known that, what I was up to, but bless his heart, he never said a word either. And I got away with that escapade, which could have gotten me into serious trouble, I suppose, had it ever become known. There was one more little incident I wish to mention here while we're on the subject of Bradley Field and things that happened there. I got a call one day. Perhaps this, I believe this was while I was still instructing, and this was before I was a flying safety officer. And I got a call from my CO, said that one of the trainees was up in a P-47 and one of the oil lines had sprung a leak and was spraying oil all over his canopy, and he couldn't see out. That is to say, he couldn't see straight ahead.